I'm here today with Glyn Williams, who is the former Director General of the Home Office and was responsible for border immigration and citizenship. So thank you for agreeing to this interview today. So first and foremost, I just wanted to get an idea about your, if you could talk me through a little bit about your career, how you came to work at the Home Office, and where your interest in issues of immigration and citizenship and border control, how that came to be.
Well, I joined the civil service in 1985, actually what was then the Department of Trade and Industry. And I had various jobs there in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office as well. And then in 2006, I moved to what was then called UK Visas, which was running which was a joint Home Office FCO operation running the UK's external visa service, which was run by Mark Sedwell at the time, who obviously went on to become Cabinet Secretary eventually. Mm-hmm. And then this was at the time that the UK Border Agency had been formed, and the UK Visas was kind of absorbed into the Home Office and then into UKBA somewhere around 2008-09 from memory. And at that point I joined the Home Office as a member of their permanent staff. And in 2010, I moved to do immigration policy in the Home Office. And at the time, that was mainly about reducing net migration to the tens of thousands with the coalition government with David Cameron as Prime Minister and Theresa May as Home Secretary. And then in 2013, I became Director for Asylum Operations. And in 2014, I was promoted to be Director of Immigration Policy, which covered both legal migration and illegal migration and asylum, and notably the compliance environment. In 2016, we obviously had the Brexit referendum, and I was still in the Home Office, but I joined the UK's negotiating team to negotiate the Citizens' Rights Agreement with the EU. And I was, you know, that was part of my wider job. I was promoted to Director General in 2017 while those negotiations were going on. And obviously, in late 2017, early 2018, the Windrush scandal broke. I actually volunteered to, the Home Office, kind of when it first came up, set up, they realised it was a sort of, you know, it required some special arrangement. So I volunteered to run something like a gold command to deal with it. And
what year was that, sorry? In 2018, was it?
That was in 2018 mm-hmm. when it hit the news, as it were. Mm-hmm. During March, April, May, I ran sort of twice daily meetings in the Home Office and advised the Home Secretary and accompanied the Home Secretary to various select committees. And from about June, July onwards, that was when Wendy Williams came in. At that point, I kind of stepped back from it and kind of resumed my day job. And I carried on until the end of 2021 when I retired, and the latter part of my job was dominated by the small boats crisis and also moving to the new post-Brexit migration system, the points-based system, and ending free movement. And then I retired at the end of 2021.
And what do you do now, currently?
I do some immigration consultancy work with Tony Smith as part of Fortinus Global, part-time.
Okay. Thank you for that. Can you give us some... give a little bit of insight, really, into how what big the Home Office was at the time. So, for example, back in where you were working at the UK visas in 2008, 2009, how big were the teams you were managing? What kind of areas were being prioritised? What were the discussions that were taking place at that time? I'm just interested in kind of creating a bit of a picture about what was happening at the Home Office.
Well, I mean, within the immigration system, there was and is 20 to 25,000 people in Border Force, Immigration Enforcement, UKVI, and then there's also the Passport Office. Plus, I mean, within policy, there would be, I don't know, 100 to 200 people, depending. So UK visas, I don't know, there were probably 500 to 1,000, I can't remember. Mainly based in British embassies around the world. You know, the big battalions were in UKVI in Sheffield in Croydon doing asylum and visa and citizenship caseworking, and then obviously Border Force all in the airports and ports. So I had, I mean, when I was doing asylum, I had probably 1,000 people working for me or something like that. When I was in policy, I had fewer people under my direct command, but I was trying to link up policy with the wider operations and to ensure there was a good join up there, which was, you know, which was a perennial challenge. I mean, while I was doing immigration, it was obviously, there was quite a big thrust in the mid-2000s to modernise the provision of services to... they were all essentially paper-based, paper applications, and the thrust was to... Well, now it's to digitise. I mean, that was obviously quite a lengthy process, and indeed isn't quite complete now, I don't think.
And when you say to digitise, you mean to literally have a digital record of every single document or information on individual cases? Or do you mean it was... Yeah, I'm just quite interested in that discussion around kind of efforts to modernise what that literally entailed.
Well, it covers quite a few different things, really. So... I mean, when I joined the visa operation in 2006, basically people filled out a paper form to apply for a visa, and they generally went to their nearest British embassy or consulate to get the visa. And that was gradually replaced with electronic applications. But initially it was kind of hybrid in that electronic applications were accompanied by a lot of paper documents that had to be submitted as well. There was a big kind of trying to modernise the customer service arrangements, which, I mean, that is in fact relevant to Windrush, because part of that was the move away from interviewing everybody and seeing everybody in person in the system to remote working, whereby most cases were dealt with on paper by the visa system or by UKVI for in-country leave to remain. Because one of the major challenges that the system was facing and still faces is just the sheer volume of business. And obviously with globalization, the number of travelers, both those needing visas and those just arriving at ports, significantly increased, and levels of student migration and work migration increased significantly. And then, of course, in 2015, on top of that, you had the asylum crisis in Europe, which led, you know, to a lot of work around asylum. So the challenge in this system was to develop systems, because you couldn't infinitely expand the number of people working in the system. So it was a question of developing processing arrangements which could deal with these kind of industrial quantities of applications, and at the same time sort of modernizing to improve customer service as people became increasingly used to just applying things on their phone. But the other big trend, though, was increasing security checks. So from 2006, we introduced fingerprints into the visa system and the immigration system generally. So people had to give their fingerprints to get a visa, which kind of went counter to the trend of trying to make things more cost effective in terms of delivery, because it meant that customers had to come in and give their fingerprints, for example. And there was a lot more sort of hooking up with various security databases and police databases.
And then, sorry, were these local, were these UK police databases? Yeah. So it's across the UK, information sharing to basically cross-check data on individuals.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, because a huge aspect of this project as well is the transnational aspect of the scandal. And I've visited already Jamaica and Barbados, and will be shortly travelling to Trinidad and Tobago. And I'm very interested in the changes that you talk about that were taking place really from the mid-2000s, because effectively these changes were being rolled out at the British embassies and high commissions, right, around the world. So different computer systems were being implemented, and different ways of actually collating people's visa applications, and actually dealing with individuals which used to be on a one-to-one basis as well, was kind of being moved towards a more kind of digitized system. Is that correct? So I'm just really interested in learning more about how that was rolled out globally, so beyond the UK, but how was it done on an individual basis, for example, that consultants from the Home Office sent to different high commissions and embassies to actually look at visa systems? Was there a strategy behind how this modernization process basically took place?
Well, yes, it's quite cool. I mean, in the visa system, the sort of the big development. So we were taking people's fingerprints, which meant people had to come in person. And we developed a system of using commercial partners to outsource the process of receiving the application and taking the fingerprints. So there was a company called VFS who started in India, and there was another one who did kind of the Americas, but VFS were the main one, and they established their own offices, which were that's what customers saw. So that was one kind of structural development in the delivery of visas, to do it in partnership with these outsourced partners, and to have much less contact between the visa officers themselves and the applicants.
And why was that decision made? Why was there a decision made to have less contact between visa applicants and decision makers? What was the rationale?
It was mainly logistical, in the sense that it was not practical to handle all these people coming into British embassies to give their fingerprints. Well, first, you needed more offices apart from in the capital cities. So there were lots of satellite offices that were set up by the commercial partners. And they could design the offices, you know, to meet these needs. And, you know, it was in the great age of outsourcing as well, where it was considered that administrative tasks were best farmed out to a partner who would do all that for you. And then the visa officers, you know, the theory was the visa officer would collect in, would have delivered to him or her the sort of application with everything there, and then they could concentrate on the decision. I mean, the other, just to sort of complete that picture, there was something going on called hub and spoke working. So prior to 2006, basically all the decision making on visas had taken place in the relevant British embassy or British consulate. And the theory of hub and spoke was that the spokes would collect in the applications, and they would then be routed through to a decision-making hub, which might, at the time, was kind of, you know, New Delhi would be the decision-making hub for India, for example.
And for the Caribbean, was it? I understood it was. Was it New York, or did it depend on which high commission?
Yeah, so there were regional. Yeah, so it wasn't necessarily in the country. I mean, there were sort of difficulties in taking decisions outside of the country in terms of transporting documents and things. But the theory was, and this was sensible, that you would get more standardised decision making and better decision quality if decision making was focused in certain geographical locations. And obviously now, I think most of it has been brought back to the UK. And I think most UK visa decisions are taken in the UK, and the UK is the hub. And also, by the way, the system for, I mean, the Labour government in 2008 introduced a points-based system for work and study migration, which the basic theory of that was objective decision making. So if you had a sponsor, i.e. an employer or a university, say if you're a student registered with UKBA and you'd been licensed by UKBA, and if you had a certain amount of money, and if you could produce documents ABC as requested, then you would get the visa kind of semi-automatically, and it wouldn't be down to subjective decision making through an interview as to your, you know, what were your motives, etc., etc. And again, that facilitated the move away from personal decision making to remote decision making.
Well, but what were some of the limitations with that decision as well? So, I mean, certainly the people that we have spoken to for this project, I think one of the issues that they were raising was, you know, that it was that personal interaction with a state official that meant that if there were issues in terms of either not submitting the right document or not understanding what they had to do to kind of complete a certain, you know, requirement, that the human element then has been all but effectively removed, right, from decision making. Do you see any limitations with that or any issues with that, or do you think that the system has improved because of these changes?
I think the system, I mean, there were ups and downs. So initially, the student visa system sort of overheated, and a lot of students, particularly I think in India and the Indian subcontinent, were getting visas because the licensing of the colleges in the UK hadn't been strict enough.
Mm.
So we went through a long, well, 2 or 3 year process of tightening all that up. And I think sort of by the time Brexit came along, we'd actually got to a good place on work, the points-based system for work and study. It was pretty stable. The policy was pretty stable. And I think the delivery was generally okay. I mean, there's always, you know, it could always be slicker, but it wasn't too bad. I think, and you know, the universities in particular went through quite a painful process of accepting they had to do much more. Yeah, they got themselves into this thing called international students, which had become very big business quite quickly during the 2000s. And the universities, you know, my impression, this isn't really to do with Windrush, but my impression is the universities were using kind of antiquated systems for recruiting students, which were okay when they were recruiting handfuls in the 1980s and 90s, which were not okay when this became very major business. So they had to go through a process of updating their systems and basically investing more in their own due diligence systems. And that was crucial to the points-based system, that the sponsor would take more responsibility for who they were recruiting.
And there was an issue. There was a scandal at London Met, wasn't there? I think. I can't remember what year that was, but when they were effectively punished for the way in which they were kind of administratively dealing with.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the few times that the ultimate sanction that existing student visa holders at London Met had to move to another university.
Mm.
I think it's probably the only time UKBA did that.
Mm.
Usually it was a question of if they weren't happy, they would reduce the number of visas that institution could get. But yeah, so the other just so there was a theme in the mid 2000s of improving customer service and improving delivery to cope with the challenge of volume. There was a theme of improving security checks through things like fingerprints and checking of databases and making decision-making more objective.
And heavily influenced post 9/11 as well, I would imagine.
The whole terrorism situation. And yeah. But the third theme was immigration abuse of visas, illegal immigration. And there had kind of been a bit of an asylum crisis at the start of the 2000s with the Balkan Wars, etc. But that had been brought under control. But there was a feeling that there were a lot of illegal immigrants in the UK, and it was increasingly difficult to deport them. So you had the foreign national offenders thing in 2006, which led to the so-called the tightening of deportation rules. But obviously the sort of big policy thrust was the so-called compliant environment from sort of 2010, but you know, there were Acts of Parliament in 2014 and 2016, which significantly widened the scope of the compliance environment in terms of bringing landlords into play and banks, and tightening up on employers. And obviously the basic idea was, if you're in the UK illegally, but you don't have the correct status, then it will be very difficult for you to have a normal existence in terms of working, banking, renting, even, you know, driving, et cetera, et cetera. And this will clamp down one way or another on illegal migration.
I mean, I know that David Lammy did, I'm quoting here, call you the architect of the hostile environment policy. How fair is that assertion, and how much of a role did you play in kind of conceptualising and rolling out that policy for the during the Theresa May government?
Well, I mean, the compliance environment started actually under the previous Labour government, who introduced penalties on employers who employed someone without status. First, and also, you know, I mentioned in 2006 the Foreign National Offenders Crisis. You know, John Reid introduced so-called automatic deportation.
Yeah.
And you know, that Labour government had been very hot on illegal being tough on illegal migration and visa abuse. The 2014 Act, which extended the powers and penalties around it introduced the landlord's right to rent scheme and tightened things up around employers. which was a bill in 2013. That actually, I was not involved in that in terms of its genesis. In 2013, I was doing asylum operations. Prior to that, I'd done reducing net migration, which is legal migration, workers and students. So I hadn't actually been involved in the developing the policy that ended up in the 2014 Act. I became Director for Immigration Policy just as the Act was passed in 2014, and I was involved in its implementation.
So tell me a bit more about the logic behind it. Was to make the day-to-day living, basically, of people who didn't have the right to live in the UK as difficult as possible to go about their lives. In terms of, you said that landlords, can you just elaborate a bit more, basically, on how that was?
Well, I mean, the theory was there was a lot of people living in the UK, and you know, nobody knows how many, or knew how many, or knows how many, but people who'd come on visas and overstayed their visa and stayed, or who'd come on a, you know, student visa and not left, or who arrived illegally without a visa at all, and who were living completely clandestinely. And obviously these people were, you know, when they were encountered, you know, these are people who had been working in the UK, renting property in the UK, had a UK driving licence, etc., had a bank account in the UK. And so it was just quite simply the thought that, well, we're going to make it difficult for them to be able to do those things in the future. And that will and we'll penalise employers and landlords who are non-compliant and who don't do proper checks. And those people will then, you know, they'll be forced out into the open, as it were, and they'll have to either leave the UK or regularise their situation. And it will also send a message to people who might be thinking of coming to the UK or thinking of overstaying their visa to reflect on whether that was a sensible idea, because, you know, life wouldn't be straightforward for them.
Did it work?
Well, it's difficult to prove, because you don't know how many people didn't come to the UK or were deterred from abusing their visas when they were already here because of the policy, and who were compliant because of it. And also, it's quite difficult to know how many people who you've never encountered just left the UK because of it. So I think it's difficult to have any sort of really hard evidence of whether it worked. But I think what it certainly did do was all responsible employers and landlords, for example, became very aware of the whole question of immigration status, and became very aware of their responsibilities in that respect.
Okay, so as you know, many people who were affected by the Windrush scandal were not in possession of a passport. So many people who came to the UK came at a time when they were either children who travelled on their parents' passport, or they did not have forms
of ID. Sorry, can I just interject? I'm just going back to your David Lammy. I was the architect. Oh, yes. Just to sum up on that. No, I wasn't the architect. I mean, I was not the architect of the 2014 legislation. I helped to implement that. I was certainly involved in 2014, 15, 16 in terms of implementation of the compliant environment, which the Cabinet Secretary, Jeremy Hayward, was very keen on. And he brought together government departments to help the Home Office in implementation. The 2016 Act, I was involved in. So basically, that Act was after the 2015 election, when the Conservatives got a majority. David Cameron's government considered that they'd been prevented from doing certain things in 2014 by the coalition. So the 2016 Act was to kind of tie up those loose ends as they saw it, and it just took everything a little bit further in terms of the powers and the responsibilities and obligations on the likes of landlords. So I was involved in that. I think it's just worth saying that at the time, my recollection, by the way, is the Labour Party, the official opposition, did not oppose those acts in Parliament. They did not vote against them at all. And everybody thought they were a good idea. When I say everybody, there was a massive, if you take legal migration, there was always a discussion about, the nature of student migration, work migration, the numbers, EU free movement was an issue, etc., etc. When it came to illegal migration, you know, that was just bad.
Yeah.
And the opposition thought it was bad, and the opposition were in favour of tough measures against it. So, I think you've got to put Lammy's remarks in that context.
No, absolutely, and thank you. I really appreciate that. I had a question about then the about the conversations that were taking place though at the time. Did anybody flag up or raise concerns about the possibility that there might be problems with approaches like this? So as I was saying earlier, for example, the increased demands on people to actually produce a passport to be able to rent a property, for example, potentially sounded like a sound policy, but actually in reality, when you think that there's a significant percentage of the UK population that don't own a passport or don't own a driving licence or have photographic evidence of who they are. Were these questions kind of about the nuances and maybe about the potential for issues arising? Were these discussed at that time? Can you remember conversations taking place? What were some of the problems that were raised or some of the concerns talked about?
Well, one problem was British people who didn't have passports, and another major issue was migrants who had old forms of documentation. So the Home Office down the years had issued, you know, various kinds of stamps and visas and paper documents. So it wasn't, you know, obviously we were moving towards the biometric residence permit, which a lot of people had got, but then equally a lot of people hadn't got it. So there was certainly a recognition that people who were here legally, either they might not have a document or employers might not recognise what they'd got.
Mm-hmm.
So quite a lot of, in my opinion, quite a lot of consultation did take place on the documentation. And certainly during the 2016 Act, I think we lengthened the list of documents that were acceptable. And the landlord's right to rent scheme was implemented. There was a pilots where it was tested out in certain locations first. So I think there was, and there were kind of quite a lot of contact groups with employer groups and landlord groups, etc. In fact, on right to rent, there was a big committee which the minister himself chaired, I think, with lots of landlord representatives looking at practical issues. So I think that aspect of it was looked at in some detail and changes were made. I think what didn't come up, to the best of my knowledge, was Windrush.
Yeah, and I'm very interested then in the engagement that the Home Office has had in terms of kind of broader engagement with, for example, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, or with different, as I've said, different embassies and high commissions. Did you look beyond basically the UK? Were the discussions very much based within, you know, kind of with government ministers and with different policymakers and advisers? I'm trying to think about how much you thought about maybe the impact of these policies beyond possibly the initial people they're intended to target, and if you had discussions with, for example, with the Caribbean High Commissioners, for example, in London at any point, or with other diplomatic representatives. Was that something that took place?
I don't specifically recall that. That's not to say it didn't take place at some level. But essentially, you know, the compliance environment was a policy that operated in the UK.
Mm. Yeah.
And it wasn't aimed at particular countries or cohorts. It was aimed at anybody who was in the UK, didn't have the right legal status.
Were there patterns that were emerging from that, though, about certain groups who possibly didn't have the right legal status, who were kind of being detected by the Home Office. Was it kind of raising issues or showing that there were certain demographics of people who were maybe becoming more visible to the system because of these policies?
I don't think there were particular. I mean, basically, there's a lot of people who came to the UK on visitor visas who just overstayed, and there was a perception that there were a lot of students who'd not left at the end of their studies. They came from a lot of different countries. I mean, obviously, a lot of migration to the UK recently has been from the Indian subcontinent and West Africa. So those countries always featured quite heavily in terms of who was being encountered by immigration enforcement.
Well, let's talk now specifically about the scandal itself then. When did you become aware of the fact that there were people who had originally arrived in the UK from the Commonwealth who were encountering problems with their status in the country? Can you remember one specific event, or was
it's initially I should say that I'd never heard the term Windrush before Amelia Gentleman's articles in The Guardian in sort of 2017. In 2017, I, as I mentioned at the start, I was doing the negotiations with the EU on citizens' rights. And in the autumn of 2017, Amelia Gentleman published some of her articles about West Indian people who were in difficulties. And the EU, in the negotiations, seized on them because they said, it'll be the same for EU citizens in the future. You're going to treat them the same, aren't you? You're going to give them a hard time. You're going to say they don't have a right to be here. You're going to try and deport them, et cetera, et cetera. That's when I sort of first became aware of it as a series of cases anyway.
And did any individual cases kind of come to your desk at all? Or was it more that there were kind of rumours circling about possible problems? I mean, did somebody within your department, for example, flag that this was, that they'd come across a specific case that they were concerned about?
I talked to immigration enforcement about what was actually going, because the basic situation, I think, was that some people had been threatened with deportation or removal anyway by immigration enforcement, and they'd lost their job or they'd been denied healthcare or whatever, and the view of, it wasn't regarded as a systemic issue. The view was that these people just needed to produce the right documentation. I mean, I think they were not, I think the cases in question, they were not actually removed from the UK. They were in a kind of limbo in that they were being threatened with removal, but they weren't actually removed. I mean, some of them had lost their employment or possibly, I don't know if right to rent had come into play or...
And struggle with access to healthcare as well.
Healthcare, yeah. Yeah.
So one thing that I think we wanted to understand more on the project is who were the people making a decision then? So say, for example, that somebody had started to receive a letter letters from the Home Office, which was questioning their legal right to remain in the country. And then they'd started that process, so they had sent, for example, their national insurance number and evidence of working in the country, and trying to basically put together a portfolio to show their legal right to be here. How would that have been processed? Whose desk would that have arrived on, and how would that decision be kind of looked at within the Home Office?
Well, it was either people who were applying to UKVI for citizenship or further leave to remain, or people who apply for a British passport, HMPO, were being turned. In fact, I think that's one of the... I think quite a lot of that happened, and it's not received very much attention compared to the other cases. Or people who had been encountered by immigration enforcement and were being detained by them, or they'd been put on bail by them.
And were you aware of cases of people being locked out, essentially, as well? Because I know Amelia writes a little bit about this, about people who were, for example, in Jamaica and then unable to actually return to the UK.
I wouldn't say I don't remember being massively aware of it, but I mean, obviously that, a visitor visa regime had been put on Jamaica in 2006, was it? Which obviously made it more difficult for Jamaicans to come to the UK first. And second...
Do you have any insight into that decision, actually, into why that decision was made for Jamaica in 2006?
I think from memory, some of that was to do with... You remember the Yardies?
Mm-hmm.
Organised criminal gangs. I think that was a quite a big element in that, I think, from memory. But obviously, it had long been the rule that if you were in the UK with indefinite leave to remain, which was the case for the Windrush who were here before, and you left the UK and you were absent for more than 2 years, you lost your resident status.
Yeah.
And I think that was what was happening to a lot of those people. But that was policy.
Mm. Okay, so let's try and build a timeline then of the time that the Amelia Gentleman started publishing articles in late 2017, 2018. And then the Windrush scandal really hits the front pages in April 2018. What happened in terms of your line of work? Because I know that you participated, as you said at the beginning of this interview, in numerous inquiries and select committees, and what happened basically at that point when you realised that this really was a huge scandal?
I've forgotten exactly what. I mean, there was a summit, wasn't there?
Yeah, the Chogham.
Yeah, where summit. I can't remember whether that was the kind of the spark that ignited. I mean, it had been sort of rumbling on from autumn 2017 with Amelia's articles in The Guardian, but it hadn't really ignited. And then it ignited.
Yeah, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in April.
I think because of that. I mean, the sort of surprising thing, to me anyway, is how it just went from a story that was simmering, but nobody, to be honest... I mean, there's a lot of other things going on, with the whole EU thing and Brexit was really focused. And it went from, you know, something that you were kind of aware of as something that, amongst many other things in the immigration system, there's always something kind of going on. And all of a sudden, it just exploded.
So I know that you, for example, you were with Sajid Javid at the Windrush Children Inquiry. Was that in May 2018?
Well, no, what happened was, so when it first blew up, I mean, first UKVI set up a task force to process Windrush applications.
Was it the hotline as well? There was a hotline that was set up.
Yeah, as part of the task force, there was a hotline. And I volunteered. So, but obviously, you know, so UKVI were involved in this as far as they were getting applications, or they wanted to actually regularise people. Immigration Enforcement were involved because they'd been detaining people or threatening to remove people. Border Force were involved in so much as possibly they were stopping people entering the UK. The visa system was involved because of the returning residence issue that you've mentioned. And obviously the compliance environment was implicated because of actions by employers, the health service, which was policy. So all of this had to be brought together into some sort of coordinated response. Mm. So, as I said, I actually volunteered to head up I don't think it had a special name, but basically I chaired meetings in the morning and in the evening of a relevant group of people from those various bits of the immigration system, operations and policy, and the Home Office's media team, etc., etc., to try to put some order into what was going on and what our response to it needed to be. And I saw the Home Secretary every day to report. It was Amber Rudd.
Yes, and you were there when she resigned as well.
Yeah, I was there when she resigned. So, I mean, one of the sort of difficulties here was, as I say, this story just blew up. And it acquired kind of a life of its own, as it were. So it became a political thing in that, if you remember at the start of it, Amber Rudd said to Parliament something like the Home Office, I think the Home Office has lost sight of individuals. Mm. And she talked about the Home Office as though it was nothing to do with her. Mm. And had it basically hung the Home Office out to dry. And I think Labour sort of, apart from the fact that there was actual, so one thing I just don't want to be misunderstood in all this is that I understand that a lot of Windrush people actually suffered harm, you know, and detriment because of what happened. And, you know, I get that and I don't want to sort of minimise that. But over and above that, this all of a sudden became a political issue in that, the Labour Party and the media kind of smelt blood. And they were obviously going to sort of go after Amber Rudd, if not the Prime Minister. And, you know, Amber Rudd eventually had to resign and Sajid Javid took over. And there were lots of sort of factual questions as to what was actually going on in terms of who, you know, was it about people coming back from abroad? Was it about people being refused passports?
Was it about removal targets as well? Was the
So there was a whole subplot about had the had the Home Office deported people, in particular people coming out of prison, back to Jamaica, etc., when they shouldn't have done so? Because, you know, there are certain sort of... The way the 1971 Act was worded in terms of deportation of Commonwealth citizens is pretty complicated. And in fact, the whole historical legal background to this is complicated and had to be kind of pieced together.
I mean, how familiar were, for example, just everyday Home Office staff with the, for example, 1962 Commonwealth Immigrants Act or the 1971 Act? I mean, did they have any grasp, basic understanding of the fact that people who, you know, for a certain period of time, there were people who came as, came perfectly legitimately to this country and had every entitlement to stay? That's the bit, I think, that for this project in particular, that really stumps me personally, is how did nobody pick up on this? Was it because... it wasn't something that was discussed or people had that knowledge, that historical knowledge, or that basic grasp of kind of changes to immigration legislation? Is it simply that people are bureaucrats and they're doing their day-to-day job and this was something that just wasn't, you know, didn't come into discussion?
I don't think come 2016, 17, 18, I don't think people were particularly familiar with the legal legislative developments, which are actually, I've had to do quite a lot of research on them since. I don't think they were particularly well understood. I think an earlier generation of immigration officers and Home Office officials were much more aware of the what is now called the Windrush generation as a kind of cohort. I just think that come, you know, the time we're talking about now, I think everybody thought that it was not an issue, that the people who arrived, you know, in the 60s and 70s, etc., and they were protected by the 71 Act to some extent, had kind of been sorted out, for want of a better expression. And I think, and I don't know if you've done any research on this, but I think before the British Nationality Act 1983, came into force in 1985, was it?
It was 1981, it came into force in 1983.
Sorry, yeah, and I think, wasn't there some kind of an exercise to get people to apply for citizenship?
Yeah, there were calls, basically, for people to register. And there were also increased the Home Office, there were passport raids and, all sorts of kind of campaigns, grassroots campaigns as well, to inform people about changes, basically, that were coming that would affect them and their children directly.
I think also, I think the if you look at the legislative development, so clearly, I mean, the Commonwealth Immigrants Act 62 and then the 68 Act and the 71 Act kind of shut the door on Commonwealth migration. The 71 Act contained, you know, the saving provision that if you're already here and settled, you could stay with indefinite leave to remain, and kind of placed them on a sort of pedestal, although it did say they're deportable for the first time. But in the 1988 Immigration Act, they restricted, there'd been a provision in the 71 Act, which was about family reunion. And that, which made it easier for Commonwealth citizens to bring in their family than non-Commonwealth citizens. that was straightened out in 88 to put them in the same position as everybody else. Then I mentioned there was the visa regime on Jamaica. When in 2006, when automatic deportation was brought in, there was no kind of exemption for Commonwealth citizens. There were no exemptions in all the compliant environment stuff starting from 2009 for Commonwealth citizens. I mean, the whole concept of Commonwealth citizens as, you know, a cohort with some kind of privileged status had gone out the window. And, you know, there was the EU and there was the rest of the world. So I don't think anybody in the Home Office thought that politically the Commonwealth was in any way, and Commonwealth citizens were in any way there to be favoured or in a special position. And insofar as anybody thought about it, you know, Windrush was something that happened in the 1970s and 80s, and, you know, wasn't the problem anymore. I mean, I'm massively generalising now, but I think
to understand how a file such as, you know, the case of the people that Amelia told about, for example, who, if a file landed on somebody's desk and they so evidently had been in the UK for 50 years and contributing and paying tax and working and sending their children to school and being a, you know, an active member of the community and of society, how that wasn't obvious, basically, to a decision maker that was...
Yeah, but that's a different matter. I'm not saying, when you come to individual cases, that's different. I'm just saying that I know that in the Home Office of 2016-17, people weren't going around saying, oh, Windrush,
talking this is just
Windrush generation.
Well, it was
there.
A term, it was termed by Amelia Gentleman as well, the term Windrush.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have existed
exactly
before then, yeah.
So
yeah.
People were not going around when the compliance environment was being developed, for example, and, you know, from the discussions I had in 2014, 15, 16, no one ever said in any meeting that I was in, well, there's this thing called the Windrush generation, who are in a really delicate position, potentially special position. We must, you know, be very, very careful how we treat them as a cohort and be on the lookout for them. That was never mentioned. As I said, there were generic issues about the compliance environment, about some people might not have the right, including British people, might not have the right documentation or might find it a bit difficult. But that was mainly in terms of how would but that wasn't specific to so-called Windrush now, first. And second, that was mainly about how employers and landlords and banks, etc., would recognise their status. It didn't seem to occur to anyone that the Home Office itself, when it came into contact with people, as in Immigration Enforcement or UKVI, would struggle to recognise their status.
Mm.
I mean, you know, rightly or wrongly, that wasn't thought about. So then you come to these individual cases where, you know, the issue was they were asked to demonstrate that they'd been in the UK continuously, i.e. they had not been absent for more than 2 years.
Yeah.
Because that was the rule. And this was taken quite literally, and they were being asked to provide proof of each year of residence.
Mm.
So when we set up the UKVI task force, it was agreed that these things would be looked at, I think the phrase in the round was used, and also that the UKVI would try and help them to establish their status. Because the 71 Act says the owner, if you're claiming you're protected by that Act under Section 1(3), was it? The onus of proof is on you, the migrant, to prove it. So the kind of default position of the Home Office was, okay, here you are, you can't demonstrate to me that you're a British citizen. You can't demonstrate to me that you have legitimate migrant status because you don't have a visa or an ILR stamp or anything. It's not my job, it's your job, and this is the legal position, it's your job to prove to me that you are in fact entitled to be in the UK.
Yeah.
And although that remained the legal position, the Home Office then became more flexible in terms of helping people to find the evidence, but also interpreting that evidence in a much more holistic way, such that if it looked as though they'd been in the UK for 50 years, but you couldn't quite account for, you know, 3 of those years or something, you would make a judgment which was in their favour.
And can I ask, what powers does the Home Office have to... I mean, was this, as you said, this whole thing was hinged on the, you know, burden of proof being on the individual, but did the Home Office, or does the Home Office have powers to look into individual cases? Do they do that, or is it all basically on the evidence that that individual provides to the Home Office? What I'm saying, for example, is if you have someone's national insurance number, and you can check, for example, their records to see that they've been paying tax or been working in employment, been employed in the UK for, let's say, 25 years, can you do that? Can you be proactive, basically, in the way that you look at somebody's file and approve or you know, reject their applications?
Yeah, but the position was, if you're saying you've worked in the UK for 25 years, you give us the payslips, you give us your national insurance record.
So it's not the other... So the onus is basically...
You get me the evidence. You go to DBP, you go to, you know, NHS, you go wherever, you give me your rental agreements, et cetera, et cetera. And you present me with a file of evidence and I'll look at it. So... It wasn't, I will help you piece it, I will go to the DWP and sort it out for you. That wasn't the approach.
Yeah, it's the individual's responsibility to provide.
But also evidence. Some people, there were, I do remember one case of a guy, basically, he'd always worked cash in hand. He didn't have a national insurance record. I don't think he didn't own a house. He sort of lived with friends. I don't think he'd sort of been to the dentist or so. He hadn't got a doctor or a you know, some people are living kind of off grid almost. It's not as straightforward in some cases as you might think to establish the truth, I think the key thing here is that the burden of proof and the requisite amount of evidence that was asked for, but kind of the mindset was not until the change, it was not to help people.
Okay, so we're coming to the end of the interview. I'm just thinking, I know that hindsight is a very useful thing, but is there anything that you would have done differently, or is there an approach that has the scandal basically, how has it influenced you in terms of your thinking about immigration, citizenship and the British state and the way that people experience the system as a whole? Is there anything A, you would have done differently, or B, that you would like to see as a change in the future?
Well, I think specifically on Windrush, I think the sort of major mistake the Home Office has made was in 2017 when Amelia Gentleman started to uncover those cases. Nobody got on it. Nobody got on it until it all hell broke loose in, you know, March 2018, and then it just got out of control.
Yeah, and I suppose it is in our interviews, for example, it was clear that the Caribbean High Commissioners were requesting meetings with the Home Office and were reporting to them individual cases, for example, and I think Philip Hammond as well. There was when he was there was a meeting, and you know, this was flagged to the British government before, a number of years before the scandal erupted. So I think that's very interesting that, as you said, people didn't get on it or didn't respond in a way that was, but didn't foresee basically that this scandal would culminate in the way that it did.
So that was a mistake. We should have spotted it and taken it seriously and tried to sort it out. I mean, maybe we would have sorted it out. I don't know. But I mean, we were playing catch from, you know, we were then playing catch up. So that was a sort of major handling mistake. I think, though, there are sort of more profound, difficult lessons from it, which is, first, there had been what I would characterise almost as a crusade against illegal migration, which no one had really questioned in terms of it being the right thing to do. And I think there was a... I don't want to sort of play a blame game here, but, you know, there was a relentless political pressure to implement a very strict compliance environment and to get results on that. And it was quite a gung-ho culture.
Sorry, what do you mean by that, by gung-ho culture?
Well, that people would... that, you know, if illegal migration, i.e. people living in the UK, people entering the UK legally and then living in the UK illegally, was regarded, still is regarded as a bad thing, a failure of the system, and, you know, unfair on all those who are playing by the rules. And, you know, being tough on people who don't play by the rules was, you know, just a real key principle, both of the Labour government and then the Conservative government. Mm-hmm. And we cranked up all the instruments of the compliance environment, together with, you know, a lot of political enthusiasm to make them work. And I think insufficient attention was paid to, you know, are you building enough safeguards into the system? And what risks are you prepared to take? I mean, I don't recall any discussion with ministers, for example, where ministers would say anything along the lines of, we want you to adopt a cautious approach, and if there are any doubts, you tread carefully, and we don't want, I know this is a horrible phrase, but we don't want collateral damage in terms of, you know, certain individuals, you know, might get rough justice, but for the greater good, you know, in terms of fight against illegal migration. Whereas later on, and maybe this was a lesson of Windrush that was learned, when we came to regularise the status of EU citizens who come under free movement after Brexit. I would say a very generous and cautious approach, as it were, favouring the citizen, was taken. There was no fee. Very little evidence was required, relatively speaking. It was that was clearly a political message to, you know, we want this done in a certain way. So I think that kind of general cultural environment is really important. I think this whole thing about burden of proof and level of evidence required is important. I think the other difficulty with the compliance environment is that there was a bit of an assumption that someone's status is black and white when it can change. And, you know, human rights come into play and...
Whereas we call it shifting the goalposts as well. There can be circumstances that change that mean somebody's... finds himself in a situation that it's not, you know, it's because legislation has changed or different requirements have moved on, but that individual might not be aware of that or actually, you know, be recognised then within that system. So citizenship is constantly changing, basically, it's shifting. I do agree that it can't be seen as black and white because that causes a lot of problems for people. So, okay, we're about to finish the interview then. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we conclude?
No, it's obviously, you know, it's probably quite a lot we could discuss further, but no, thank you.
Oh, no, thank you very much for your time.